Good morning to Prince George out there basking in summer's chemical smog. And a good morning also to listeners who may have tuned in by accident or by design. From Victoria, Arizona, Hawaii, New South Wales, Lillooet, and other places more or less god-awful.
All right,
today is the 20th of August in the year of their Lord, 2002. By golly, what a beautiful day for cynicism. This is Uncle Don, and the show is Uncle Don Reads the Comics. This program on CFUR 88.7 FM in Prince George is designed to have something to offend everyone, in addition to sharing the insights of an old bugger who's been around longer than you. At this point, I'm going to interrupt the bits that I intended to present today to insert an important item that I do not want to let go unnoted. Yesterday's lead editorial in the Globe and Mail said a number of things that I've been trying to get across about the United States under the George Bush regime. I will read it in its entirety. Remember that the Globe and Mail is not some inconsequential rag, and that it is generally to the right of the political spectrum in its editorials. As a former citizen of the United States, this editorial scares the hell out of me and confirms my resolve never to return the U.S. of A., even to change planes. Here is the editorial, headlined, "When Violating Rights Becomes Routine." The U.S. government and its crackdown on terrorism has been demanding that bookstores, libraries, and newspapers turn over certain records. What individuals read is now of profound interest to the state. But when a committee of Congress asked Attorney General John Ashcroft last week about these and other investigative tactics, Mr. Ashcroft would not answer directly. The usual legislative checks on executive power, it seems, don't apply. It's wartime. The judiciary, too, is being asked to lie low for a while. President George W. Bush opposes any meaningful judicial review of certain detentions. If his administration says someone is an enemy combatant, that should be enough. It's wartime. Fighting terrorism is vitally important, but the administration appears willing to chuck the Constitution out the window while doing so. Wartime or not, Americans should be frightened by this. A U.S. citizen is held indefinitely without the right to a lawyer. Immigration violations are a pretext for long-term preventive detention without criminal charges being laid. Deportation hearings for non-citizens occur in secret. Even family members are barred. Someone informs police of a suspicious neighbor. That neighbor is picked up and held incommunicado. The government has yet to make a persuasive case on how greater transparency would harm national security. Warren Christopher, who was Secretary of State under Bill Clinton, likens the detention since September 11th of more than 1,200 people, mostly of Middle Eastern descent, to Argentina's disappearance in the 1970s. Their identities have been kept secret. Many of them have been held without counsel. We must be very careful in this country about taking people into custody without revealing their names. Another important concern has been raised by federal judge William Young in Boston, who is aghast at President Bush's plan to suspend suspected foreign terrorists before military tribunals. This would diminish the role of the judiciary, once the central feature of American justice, he said, calling it the most profound shift in our legal institutions in his lifetime. The government's determination to be free of constitutional norms and the prying questions of impertinent judges is clear in the case of Yasser Hamidi, 21, who was born in Louisiana and raised in Saudi Arabia. Jailed in the United States since April, this U.S. citizen is not permitted to speak to a lawyer and has not been charged with any offense. So, the Constitution doesn't apply to Mr. Hamdi? Demanded Judge Robert Dumas, an appointee of Ronald Reagan. The government's lawyer replied that it's the president's job to decide what to do with captives. Judges have a limited role to play. Judge Dumas could find no precedent for this sort of state behavior. He compared it to medieval England's secret hearings in the Star Chamber. Twice he insisted that Mr. Hamdi be allowed access to a lawyer. Twice an appeals court asked him to give the government more room to make its case. The government did present a two-page statement explaining that a military screening team found that Mr. Hamdi met the criteria for enemy combatants, but the government did not explain what the criteria are or in which way Mr. Hamdi met them. Why am I here? Judge Dumas asked in exasperation. It's a question that should ring loud and clear. An independent judiciary is a crucial line of defense, not only for those behind bars without voice or name, but for the timeless values of the Constitution. Constitutions are best drafted in peace and most needed in war. During the Second World War, 110,000 people of Japanese ancestry were interned. During the Cold War, the poison of McCarthyism infested the country. That is why Judge Dumas is there, to ask questions and to insist on answers. That was the lead editorial in the Globe and Mail on the 19th of August, entitled Violating Rights Becomes the Routine. The United States has held itself before the world as a model of democracy with its Constitution providing checks and balances between the Congress, the executive, and the judiciary. All power has now been arrogated by the executive branch, and the Bill of Rights, another matter of American pride, has been dismissed as irrelevant during this time of, quote, war. Let us keep in mind that this war was the product of some 19 men who pulled off a stunt that destroyed two buildings in New York and killed fewer than 3,000 people. In a world that is exploding with millions of deaths in dozens of wars, declared and undeclared, this is pretty small potatoes. This massive overreaction, which has seen Bush snatch power, is without precedent or excuse. And now, back to my regular programming. Organic food. The Prince George Public Interest Research Group will be resuming its organic food distribution in September. If they follow last year's pattern, boxes of assorted fruits and vegetables will be available weekly for several fixed prices. Each week's selection will depend on what is available. Last year, my wife and I picked the $20 boxes and found them a good buy. If you want good organic produce at a reasonable price, check with the PIRG office at the university for details. Call them at 960-7474 or drop into their office on the UNBC campus. There will also be occasional orders of dry and canned goods from Horizon Food Distributors in Vancouver. By pooling orders, PIRG can get a discounted freight charge. So if you want dried fruits, cereals, flour, and such, check out the Horizon catalog at the PIRG office. In the past, we have ordered bulk organic raisins, oatmeal, granola, soy sauce, and stuff like that, which is not available in town. PIRG will be looking for volunteers to help sort and distribute the produce, so if you have some spare time and want to meet some good people, sign up to help. Now, a public service announcement, as required by the CRTC and CFURFM. The UNBC Campus Health and Wellness Center will be changing the hours of its needle exchange from Tuesdays and Thursdays to Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, effective the first week of classes. The hours will remain as before, 1 p.m. to 4 p.m. The Health and Wellness Center has asked us to remind you that Smokey's friends don't share needles. And another time change that will be coming with the commencement of classes here on the first week of September will be this program. Uncle Don is moving from Tuesdays at 11:30 to Wednesdays at the same time. Mark that on your calendars. I did not specify a.m. or p.m. When you get to be my age, there is no 11:30 p.m. unless it is for a bladder call. Bedtime is between 9 and 10. You'll see. The Bush interview. I still had no reply to my letter of the 16th of last month inviting Georgie, son of a Bush, to this program to defend himself against the attacks I have made on him. Is he afraid of me? I am willing to submit to a body search by his goons or any other indignities that he may suggest. I'm used to harassment in the name of security. I have flown from an American airport. The only condition I have attached to his presence is that he bring his henchmen onto campus unarmed. We don't need swaggering bullies with sidearms upsetting the students on the anniversary of the fall of the World Trade Center. In the event of Son of a Bush's absence on the 11th of September, I intend to have a program that morning dedicated to discussing the last year as it has affected world events, wars, and civil rights. Tune in. Something to offend everyone, especially if you believe that terrorism is the greatest threat to our society. Statistics. Just recently, I had a conversation with one of the folks here at the radio station who was planning to emigrate to Europe. He's not sure where, but in the course of the conversation, he brought up the fact that Sweden has the world's highest suicide rate. I went home and cogitated on this fact. Could it be that Sweden has more accurate statistics than other countries, rather than more suicides? Is it just possible that our statistics understate suicides to avoid embarrassment amongst survivors? Might a religious family ascribe a suicide by drug overdose to an accidental overdose, or a suicide by gunshot be blamed on an accident having happened while cleaning a gun? Are we just fooling ourselves with our statistics? The following is a true story. Bear with me. I am going somewhere with this. I once worked in a provincial government department with a fellow who told me that one of his earlier jobs involved the collecting of monthly statistics from several branch offices, consolidating them, and submitting the totals to Victoria, where they became part of some government report. He had problems in getting timely reports from all of the branch offices save one, which always had their figures on time. After some months, he had occasion to visit the one office that was always punctual. He asked to see the department that produced the figures so readily and was told by the man showing him around, "That's me." "How in hell do you get all those figures together on time when no one else can?" the fellow candidly replied. "I make a guess and carry it out to four figures." By plugging in phony statistics at any level, the entire compounded figures are skewed. Another example of phony statistics was the body counts that were issued by the U.S. government during the Vietnam War. It was a rule of thumb amongst military experts that a guerrilla war could only be won by the occupying power maintaining a 10-to-1 kill ratio over guerrillas. The announced body counts were predictable, and we all came to play a game. When we heard an announcer say that X Americans had been killed in some battle, we tried to guess the figure, what the figure would be for the Vietnamese dead before the announcer told us. The applicable formula we used was 10X plus Y. Thus, 5 American dead would mean 50-some Vietnamese. It became so ridiculous that the U.S. government stopped announcing figures altogether. I strongly suspect that many of the statistics that we are fed are derived in the same way. Make a mental note of this and think about it. 97% of all statistics are bullshit. Donations. Here's a figure that is not fabricated. $10,000, Canadian. That's the amount that the BC Liberal Party is suggesting that people who work in public relations donate to their party. The Globe and Mail disclosed that they have a copy of a letter sent by the Liberals to, quote, people in the communications field. The letter said that the public relations, that is, propaganda, industry, has not given its share to support the government's, quote, initiatives to opening this province for business. There it is, right up front. We have been taking care of you, now you take care of us. There is certainly no linkage between donations from propagandists and the awarding of advertising contracts by the provincial regime. No, indeedy-do. A provincial Liberal spokesman is quoted as saying that, the government does have an open tendering process, so whether somebody donates would not help them in obtaining a government contract. Believe that one? Off to bingo with you. You are wasting your time listening to this. Personal experience. I was once in a position within the BC provincial government where I was involved with an annual contract with a local business for the provision of a service. The holder of the current contract had been giving us a bad time. When I requested the purchasing commission to solicit tenders for a contract renewal, I submitted a list of businesses to which solicitations should be submitted. I forgot to list the current supplier, an oversight of course, and there was a bit of a stink when the new contract went to a different supplier, but I weathered the storm. The new contract went to a company of Jimmy Pattison's, and he carried a lot of weight with the SOCRED regime of the day. Yes, I have no doubt that future contracts for government advertising will find their way to firms which have not neglected their duty to contribute to this bunch of parasites and destroyers in Victoria. Pride Day. Well, the City Council has again refused to issue a proclamation of Pride Day. Way to go, all of those who want to erase the image of Prince George as a bastion of redneck culture. Now our name has been plastered all over the country as the place that ignores the Human Rights Commission. Great. This is the best thing to happen to the city since Hedy Fry announced that we use burning crosses in lieu of streetlights here. I hope that this bit of nonsense will bolster support for Pride Day and get everyone out for the celebration. The parade and the events in Fort George Park are a lot of fun. My wife and I and our grandson Bradley will be there. We took our grandson to the Gay Pride Day parade 2 years ago when he was 2 years old. My wife snapped a picture of him in the arms of one of the participants, a friendly, burly fellow in a skirt. We put the photo in Bradley's album and forgot all about it. One day, Bradley's father, a logger who is estranged from Bradley's mother, was over at our house looking through the album. He saw the picture and asked what it was about. When we told him, Daddy went postal. He told us never to take his son to such an event. We made it clear that as long as we were providing free babysitting for his son, we would take him with us wherever we go, and that was not negotiable. It was glorious. Daddy left in a huff. Oil. Before the big oil crisis of the early 70s, the big oil companies, all foreign, assured Canadians that our oil supplies were enough to last hundreds of years. Since nuclear power would soon make energy so cheap that it would not even be metered, that oil in the ground would soon be obsolete. Therefore, it was in Canada's best interest to sell off our easily accessible oil in southern Alberta fast. I believe royalties at that time ran in the neighborhood of 10 cents a barrel. Enter the supposed embargo of oil by OPEC in the 70s. Suddenly, the oil companies changed their tune and began to warn of impending oil shortages in Canada. The price had to rise to encourage exploration, etc., etc. Funny thing, but people soon forgot the predictions of unlimited oil and embraced the idea of shortages that meant higher prices at the pump. Needless to say, the oil companies made out like bandits on both ends of this story. In fact, they made out exactly like bandits. It was the experience that led Pierre Trudeau to form Petro-Canada to provide the government with a window into the secretive oil business so that Canadians would have accurate information on costs and resources. These figures had been deep secrets of foreign companies. So Petro-Canada became a player in the Canadian oil business. But instead of acting on our behalf, it became just another profit-centered corporation screwing the public. Now Mulroney and Chrétien have sold off all but a minority interest of Petro-Canada, and we're back in the arms of Shell, Exxon, Husky, Chevron, and their ilk. We Canadians are slow learners. We are now locked into a trade deal with the states that guarantees that we will continue to ship a percentage of our oil and natural gas production to these states regardless of our own needs. If there's a world oil crunch, and there will be, we cannot take care of Canadian needs first. We will sit freezing in the dark and watch our Canadian oil flow south to feed the SUVs and military machine there. When that happens, let us not forget to curse the traitors in both the Liberal and Conservative parties who sold us out on this one. Now I see from the papers that some American and Russian scientists have resurrected a hypothesis that oil is created deep underground through huge pressures acting on buried iron, marble, and water. Presto, instant oil. Haven't we been through this one before? The implication of this, of course, is that oil is not an ancient residue of buried vegetable matter, but is being continuously produced today. If it is being produced now, there's no need to worry about running out. Therefore, there's no need for conservation, and we can continue to burn our energy resources without a thought for the future. Never mind the consensus of real scientists is that oil production in the world will peak in 20 or 30 years, and that there will then be a mad scramble to get a share of the precious resource that we are presently wasting in big box vehicles and toys like snowmobiles and ATVs. Carry on wasting. Everything will be fine, and your grandchildren will not freeze in the dark. No prizes for listeners who can guess who financed this research. Liquor stores. Here's another item to chew on. The provincial government has announced that it will sell off our liquor stores to capitalists. No doubt these will be liberal capitalists, but no matter. The government has announced that no small communities that now have liquor stores will be left without a booze outlet after the sale of these cash cows. It is reassuring that the alcoholics will not be forced to travel to another community to stock up on their chosen drug. But would it not be comforting if the current provincial regime were to assure us that no one would be left without local medical care as they go about dismantling the health care system and closing hospitals in Prince George? No such assurance is there. Which is more important, booze or fast medical attention? World Trade Center. Let's talk about New York. There was a recent Globe and Mail article headlined, New Yorkers Disappointed by WTC Proposals. It seems that all of the proposed reconstruction plans for the World Trade Center site focus on the dollars of revenue that can be milked from the site, while New Yorkers are more intent on memorializing the dead. The critics, including the former mayor of New York, are hoping for a soaring memorial rather than another office retail complex. The Port Authority of New York and New Jersey, the public corporation that owns the 6.5-hectare site, wants to rebuild all of the lost square meters of office, hotel, and retail sales space. They want the revenue restored. I can see that, as that is their business. There have been 6 submissions by architects for rebuilding on the site. I would humbly suggest a 7th, but first a bit of background. I knew that area before the World Trade Center was built. When I was freed by the U.S. Army and before I resumed my full-time studies, I worked for a few months as a messenger for the Port of New York Authority, as it was then known. I traveled around Manhattan delivering and picking up all manner of stuff for the Port Authority. Some of this stuff related to the World Trade Center, which was then in the planning stages. I recall that the lobby of the Port Authority building on 9th Avenue had a model of the proposed towers displayed under glass. I thought it was ugly then, and nothing about the constructed buildings changed my mind. In any case, at that time, the area where the towers were to be built was a bustling commercial district of some 50 or so square blocks. It was a vibrant area that I've been told had no peer anywhere in the world. There were thousands of stores and many more thousands of residents there. In the stores, you could find the greatest variety of goods from around the world available anywhere. These small stores were largely owned by immigrants, and hundreds of languages could be heard in the streets. My father used to walk through this area on his way home from work, and he was always buying things to feed his current hobbies. He was into tropical fish at one time, and there were dozens of pet stores in this block with exotic fish that he schlepped home. Then he was into HO model trains, and he would pick up kits and parts at the many hobby shops there. And photography was another interest, so he could find any specialized stuff he needed in that area of Lower Manhattan. The Port Authority exercised eminent domain and destroyed that whole neighborhood, displacing all of the residents and stores. Some of the stores moved to other places, but most were just closed and their services lost to New Yorkers. Who knows where the people went? The Port Authority did not care. My suggestion for redevelopment is to restore that old neighborhood and try to recultivate the vibrant retail and residential area as much as possible. To hell with skyscrapers. They are becoming obsolete as big business is gradually dispersing to suburban locations. With today's communications, these corporations do not need to be on top of each other anymore. And there's a lot of pressure on corporations to locate in areas that are more readily accessible to their personnel. Back in the 60s and 70s, it took my father an hour and a half each way to commute from the suburbs to his office in New York. 3 hours a day were wasted in travel by auto, then train, subway, and on foot to get each way. I can imagine it's quite a bit longer now. The stress helped bring him an early death. Corporations are beginning to factor into their plans that stress on employees. As a kicker, does New York really need another million square meters of office space? Tobacco. I want to give public thanks to a class of much maligned people, the smokers who are still alive. I appreciate these people as long as they are downwind. These good folks voluntarily pay a portion of the taxes that I would be paying if they were not shoveling out $6.50 for a score of paper-wrapped weed sticks. I used to smoke, but I gave it up for economic reasons. In the U.S. Army, I was living on $35 a month after a savings allotment was taken out of my miserable pay. Every payday, I went to the post exchange and bought 5 cartons of Kent cigarettes, which I carefully stashed in my footlocker, a box at the foot of my bunk which contained all of my worldly goods. I changed the remainder of my pay into $1 bills and put one in each of 31 envelopes, one for each day of the month, which I had numbered for the days. For the first 3 days after payday, the post was quiet as most soldiers were in town, throwing their money at the bars and the hookers. On those days, I went to the movies on base, 25 cents, bought a coffee in the air-conditioned cafeteria, 5 cents, and read a book. After the 3 days were up, the broke soldiers infested the base at night, and it was safe to go into Panama City, in the bus, 10 cents, and buy a draft beer or two, 10 cents each, or a bottle in an upscale bar for 25 cents. Then I could go to Hollywood and buy a joint for another dime. I will tell you about Hollywood another time. If I did not go home with change from my day's dollar, something was wrong. After following this routine for a long time, I was in this rut on one base for 32 months, I decided that the cigarettes were crowding my discretionary income and I quit cold turkey. This was after a lot of false starts which lasted for a few hours each. One day I had a cold and felt too miserable to think of sucking smoke into my abused lungs. I went without a cigarette all day. The next morning I felt better but decided against smoking until after breakfast, then until after coffee break, then lunch, then dinner. So far, so good. It was after dinner that the craving was unbearable, so I ran around a parade ground until I was winded. I found that if I could not breathe, I did not want to smoke. I did this for several days until the need for tobacco decreased to a manageable level, and I finally found myself free of the habit after a few months. I have to say, though, that I had nightmares of smoking for at least a year. My quitting pain was eased somewhat by later visits to Hollywood, where I could buy that Primo Panama Red. A joint was a dime, as I said, and I never remember being able to finish one by myself. I said that my quitting was because of expense. Are you smokers seated? My king-size filter Kents cost 96 cents, a carton. My monthly habit cost me less than $5. The second time I quit was just as hard.